Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. This morning we travel to the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea. Correspondent John Ryan tells us it's one of the largest estuaries for seabirds in the world. It's being threatened by rats from Seattle. In the second half of the show, we'll celebrate Day of the Dead and Halloween. Northwest families often blend the two traditions together. But first, we look at the problems of housing and homelessness. Housing is tight for many right now. For veterans, it can be particularly challenging. Last November, First Lady Michelle Obama encouraged mayors around the country to make a commitment to end veteran homelessness in 2015. The mayors of Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, rose to the challenge, and progress has been made over the past year in Operation 365. We learn there's still a lot of work to do.
One of the people on the front lines in fighting veteran homelessness is Lori Perkins. Since moving to Eugene more than a decade ago, Perkins has dedicated herself to veteran housing. She shows me around this four-bedroom house in West Eugene.
This is their living area. You know, they're watching movies and football games and just relaxing.
There's a shared kitchen, two bathrooms. Perkins is getting ready to rent out each bedroom to a veteran in need of a home. She says she tries to help vets not only with housing, but also with accessing resources.
So, you know, when you're homeless, you're kind of stuck in that rut. So I want to bring them in and show them, you know, there is life after serving. And we bring them in, we help them, get them to the agencies, doctor's appointments, and just help raise their spirits and just help them to move forward.
Perkins owns six other homes in Eugene with rooms for male veterans. Jeff Engelstad lives in one of them. He's a 48-year-old vet who was on the edge of homelessness when he met Perkins.
I had an addiction problem, and I still do, and I was having a hard time coming out of treatment, and I was unable to find housing.
Perkins encouraged him to move into one of her rentals. She requires tenants to be clean and sober. That works well for Engelstad.
Having that clean environment and then having people around you that are clean, sober, doing the things they're supposed to do, and you can't walk out and find any of that. And I've run into people that are saying, well, it was either that or I was heading back to the park. And for this has just been, you know, an amazing turn for everybody.
At this newly refurbished house, Perkins put in a sprinkler system and locks on the bedroom doors. This allows each tenant to have his own lease. Todd Schneider is with the City of Eugene, which helped Perkins with the project.
It not only provides a room that costs a lot less than a full-scale apartment, but it makes it eligible for veterans support housing vouchers or VASH vouchers. That way, the vets, once they get here, actually have a way to keep paying rent.
Schneider says this is a pilot project for single-room occupancy veterans housing. It also provides support for people who are dealing with addiction or illness. Lori Perkins says it's always challenging to finance her projects to house veterans, but she was inspired to do this work by her late husband, who was a veteran.
I like safe places, and I want this to be a safe place. They've been out there with all of that. I want them to call this home, like you and I, and just come home, you know, go to work, school, and come home.
Perkins is not the only one working on this effort. So far, Lane County has housed about 300 veterans in the Mayor's Challenge to End Veteran Homelessness. At this rate, it may achieve Operation 365 and house a vet a day for 2015 by the end of the year. I'm Rachel McDonald in Eugene.
Bulgur, quinoa, amaranth, spelt. If you know these grains, you've probably spent some time in the grocery store and noticed the increasing prominence of gluten-free or ancient grains on labels. Tom Bonsi tells us that for industry trade groups, sales of alternatives to modern wheat and corn are growing at double-digit annual rates.
Wayne Carlson became a convert to Ethiopia's staple grain while doing public health work in Africa in the mid-1970s. The tiny grain is called teff, T-E-F-F, and it has a mild, nutty, or earthy taste.
I came to know teff because I was eating it all the time and hosted by teff farmers.
Teff flour is the key ingredient for the signature spongy flatbread found in Ethiopian restaurants. In the late 70s, Carlson returned to America, got married, and settled in southwest Idaho. Then he hatched the idea to introduce teff grass to the inland northwest.
Geologically, it's very similar to Ethiopia. Ethiopia is placed on the East African Rift Valley, which is very much like the Snake River Plain.
Neither Wayne nor his wife Elizabeth are farmers or want to be, so they convinced actual farmers in Idaho, Oregon, and Nevada to grow teff on contract for them, and they mill it. Until last year, though, there wasn't a single Ethiopian restaurant or bakery in the entire state of Idaho to sell the milled flour to.
The way we started was Wayne went through the Washington, D.C. telephone book and looked for the names that were Ethiopian.
And that's the way the business slowly grew for several decades, serving the far-flung Ethiopian and Eritrean immigrant community. The teff company has outgrown four different mills. The first was a little stone grinder in the Carlson's basement. They currently occupy a remodeled brewery complex in Nampa, Idaho. Carlson say the teff flour coming off this packing line could well land in an upscale natural food store now, or a commercial bakery.
I think there are people who are interested in new grains, nutritious foods.
Are you a believer now?
I guess I'd have to say yes. Yeah. I don't think I anticipated it would grow as it has.
A marketing flyer for the teff company says, "Move over, quinoa, there's a new grain in town." There is, in fact, a whole suite of unfamiliar grains now competing for shelf space and consumer attention. You could also try amaranth, sorghum, millet, spelt, einkorn, or emmer, some of which are locally grown and some even touted as superfoods.
Well, the ancient grain movement, I think, is largely driven by the desire for gluten-free foods.
That's Frank Morton, a seed grower from Philomath in Oregon's Willamette Valley. Besides going gluten-free, people are showing interest in whole grains for the taste, health benefits, or heirloom non-industrial heritage. The food commands premium prices. Morton has been breeding quinoa plants for about as long as the Carlsons have been pioneering teff. He says he's got six varieties ready for prime time.
And they are now going out to farmers, and they're being tested from Port Townsend, Washington, to Pasco, and all through Oregon. And somebody soon is going to begin producing quinoa commercially in the Pacific Northwest.
It's taken so long, Morton says, because he's had to adapt the quinoa to the local climate. Researchers from Oregon State and Washington State universities worked on this too. The original quinoa varieties from the highlands of South America could not tolerate our hottest summer days or rain at harvest time. I'm Tom Bonsi in Nampa, Idaho.
Biologists and tribal officials in the Bering Sea off Alaska's west coast are working to protect one of the world's great gatherings of seabirds. They're trying to keep the rats of Seattle away from the birds of the Pribilof Islands. John Ryan reports from Alaska's St. Paul Island.
The Pribilofs are famous for their millions of seabirds. By the time October rolls around, the birds have headed far out to sea. The island's nesting cliffs are mostly silent, except for the wind and the waves crashing in from the Bering Sea. But efforts to protect the seabirds of the Pribilofs go year-round. In a classroom at the St. Paul School, middle schoolers are learning just how fast rats can multiply if you give them half a chance. One pile of jelly beans on the table represents rats, another seabirds. The pile of rats grows a lot faster than the pile of birds.
So if 64 females each has 8 babies, what are we getting up to now?
I have 12.
Yeah, that's what
I got.
12?
Yeah. Okay.
The students learn that a female rat can have up to 14 babies at a time, as often as once a month. All those hungry rats like to eat the eggs, chicks, and brains of seabirds.
One pregnant rat having 8 offspring. They would wipe out 50,000 birds in 6 months.
So you can see why it's important to keep rats off the island.
Yeah.
The somewhat grisly math exercise is part of Bering Sea Days. It's a week of classes focused on the biology and traditions of the Pribilofs, with guest teachers from near and far.
So the Pribilofs are globally important for seabirds.
Anne Harding is a seabird biologist from Cordova. She's one of the guest instructors who've come out to St. Paul, some 300 miles out in the Bering Sea.
It's one of the few places where people really do live right with the birds, the community right in the middle of all these crazy, huge seabird colonies.
Nobody's seen a rat on St. Paul since some dead ones were spotted in the 1990s. Paul Melavidov is with the tribal government's eco office.
The Pribilof Islands are rat-free, and we'd like to keep it that way.
St. Paul has long had dozens of rat traps at its harbor and elsewhere. You can see the bright yellow barrels with holes in the side and traps on a platform inside throughout the village of 400 people. But for a long time, nobody knew whether the traps worked or not. They never caught any rats. So this spring, Melavidov went to the nation's busiest fishing port, where finding rats is a lot easier.
We spent a couple weeks in a Dutch harbor in Alaska.
They got permission to set traps outside the big Unicy fish processing plant and by the Unalaska landfill.
These yellow barrel stations were very effective. Over a two-week period, I think we caught about 18 rats.
Melavidov says it was the first time he'd ever seen a rat.
An experience I don't want to ever witness on St. Paul. That's the bottom line.
The rat traps are a backstop. The tribal government views education as the first line of defense against a rat invasion. That applies both to getting kids not to mess around with the yellow barrel traps and working with boat owners. The most likely way for rats to invade these remote islands would be stowing away on a cargo or fishing boat coming from some rat-infested harbor like Dutch Harbor or Seattle. The crab boats that are getting ready to start fishing this week off the Pribilofs mostly come from Seattle. It's one of the most rat-infested cities in the nation.
We're trying to gain some rapport with the captains that come on into the harbor and let them understand that, you know, this is a rat-free island and how important it is to the community of St. Paul.
Melavidov says nearly all the crab boats have agreed to have voluntary rat inspections. He says it's been harder to get inspectors on board the ships that bring groceries and other cargo to St. Paul. They often arrive and unload in the middle of the night. I'm John Ryan, reporting from St. Paul, Alaska.
And with one more for the birds, Eugene, Oregon birder Noah Stricker has achieved his goal of seeing 5,000 different birds during his International Big Year of Birding.
Stricker unofficially broke the Big Year world record last month when he spotted his 4,342nd bird in India. On Sunday, Stricker left this phone message for his dad, Bob Kiefer.
Just calling to say we just hit number 5K with a flame-crowned flower pecker in the hills of Mindanao, and it's a beautiful morning, and now we are hanging out waiting for a Philippine eagle. So I guess I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Noah Stricker started his journey on January 1st in the Arctic. He's been connecting with local bird watchers all over the world. He's funding the trip with proceeds from a book contract. Stricker is also blogging at audubon.org. He isn't stopping at 5,000. He'll continue his adventure, finishing up his big year in Australia. I'm Rachel McDonald reporting.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio. In the second half of the show, we honor the Day of the Dead. We'll think about our mortality and learn about sugar skulls with Carrie Gallagher. Right now, we turn to Jacob Lewin from Portland. He's asking the question if there's a difference in the terms Latino and Hispanic. Is it a difference without a distinction?
Terry Blass is an Oregonian whose mom came from Mexico and dad came from Utah. He wasn't completely sure if he was Latino or Hispanic, and found that friends didn't know the difference, nor did Latinos he met. Blass draws webcomics for a living and decided to produce one on the question of Hispanic versus Latino.
Making the comic was just a fun educational way for me to sort through these terms that have always applied to me. It was almost a therapeutic thing to just create this little story, and I didn't expect it to get any attention.
His first research step was logical. He asked his mom.
She said in her eyes, Hispanic was someone who came from a country that spoke Spanish, and that Latino was someone who came from a country that was Latin American.
Blass looked at some studies and then reached into his old-fashioned box filled with drawing pencils and Japanese brush pens and got to work. He settled on definitions pretty close to his mom's. Latinos are from Latin America, basically everything south of the U.S. Hispanics are from countries whose primary language is Spanish. So, if I'm from Spain?
If you're from Spain, I would say that you're Hispanic.
Brazil?
They speak Portuguese in Brazil, so I am told by the Brazilians I know that they're Latino and not Hispanic.
Mexico?
I would say both.
Blodgett, Oregon?
I've never been. I would say Oregon. I guess it depends on who you are in Oregon.
Blass's definitions have been challenged, but Erlinda Gonzalez-Berry, a former OSU professor who wrote the book Mexicanos in Oregon, says he's on the right track. She says in Spanish, Latin America is either America Latina or Latino America, and that's where the word Latino comes from. But the U.S. Census has a different definition. Charles Reinerson at Portland State University coordinates census data for Oregon. He says the census asks if you are Hispanic or Latino.
It's somewhat similar to how they ask about other races, such as Black or African American. Those are just a matter of preference of the individual. Hispanic and Latino are interchangeable.
Reinerson says that preference varies depending on which part of the country you're in.
A large number of American Latinos prefer the term Latino over Hispanic, and that was especially true in the western United States, where the majority of our Latino population is of Mexican origin.
Terry Blass now thinks of himself as Latino and Hispanic, and his comic has gotten attention from Latino media around the country. But what does his mom think?
My mother read the comic and requested a few copies. I think she liked it. I think she enjoyed it. That felt nice.
Blass's comic, You Say Latino, has gotten 200,000 hits and counting. In Portland, I'm Jacob Lewin.
Just as this year's Halloween is ending, Dios de los Muertos will be beginning. Many Northwest Latino families are getting ready now, and many blend the two holidays, modern Halloween and the traditional Day of the Dead.
In Pasco, Washington, bakeries can hardly churn out enough seasonal pan muerto. It's a type of semi-sweet bread that has the shapes of bones and skulls baked right in. Just down the street at the Supermex supermarket, managers are highlighting items from around the store that can go into a Day of the Dead altar, like flowers, fruit, traditional foods, favorite alcohols, candies, and mementos. Some are celebrating the Halloween Day of the Dead fusion this week, like Lenore Panduro and her daughters.
I feel Mexico is my home. The United States is my second home. For my daughters, the United States is their first home because that's where they were born. But I don't want them to forget where I came from.
The dead are believed to eat their fill from their family's Day of the Dead altar. After that, the food, pan muerto, and candies are fair game for the living. I'm Anna King in Pasco.
And in our final feature this morning, Carrie Gallagher went in search of the dead, the Day of the Dead, that is, here on the North Coast. Carrie tells us a celebration of life is what the Day of the Dead is all about.
Over the past few years near Halloween, I see what I have now learned to call sugar skulls. They're more and more in popular culture, brightly decorated human skulls that are typically adorned with bright flowers. I don't remember them from my childhood, but I've seen them in the last few years in artwork and at craft fairs. There are tutorials on how to paint your face to look like one, and you can find them in tattoo parlor lobbies as a popular tattoo choice. I've even seen them as cookies in my favorite bakery. Even though the skeleton is a popular symbol in Halloween observance, sugar skulls do not originate from Halloween celebrations. They are part of the Mexican celebration Dios de los Muertos, a holiday that is observed on November 1st, one day after the long popular holiday of candy and monsters. Dios de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, has been growing in popularity in the United States, and the sugar skulls, or calaveras de azúcar, are beautiful to look at and symbolize a deep connection to deceased relatives. A big difference in celebrating Dios de los Muertos is that it's a happy and celebratory day, whereas skeletons and Halloween observances are scary and sad or creepy. Dios de los Muertos is the opposite of that. Those skeletons in the ground, they are past loved ones, and the loved ones of past loved ones, they are familia. And on this day, we invite them to celebrate with us, hoping that we can talk to them on the day when the curtain between our world and their world is fragile and thin. You clean up your house, you fix your dead relatives' favorite dishes, you take time to tell stories about when you were together, just as you would if they were there. And then there are the sugar skulls, those iconic skulls with flowers and gemstones. I set out to see if I could find any in Astoria, and it didn't take me long to find all kinds of calaveras in a shop called Cargo. The store is full of colorful masks, bright paper flowers, and bright, happy skeletons posed doing all kinds of living celebrations, dancing, playing guitars, singing, even cooking and gardening. Jim Defoe was behind the counter, and I asked him who has been buying up the Dios de los Muertos decorations.
Everybody's been buying it for different reasons, not just for Day of the Dead or for Halloween, but just for year-round. Yeah, and we have it year-round, but in the past we've done more of a traditional altar, and this last couple years we've kind of made it a little more fun.
I found out that the reason Cargo has so much Dios de los Muertos items is because the founder of the store has a special connection to the holiday and has an annual party to celebrate.
We're an international company, but Patty, who is the owner and founder, she's always made that a huge part of her life in Portland. So she makes altars at her house. She makes altars in her stores, and she encourages people to celebrate the occasion by bringing in something for their loved ones, a picture, a memorial.
And if you want to learn more about this holiday from the culture that brought us this celebration, you can stop by the Dios de los Muertos celebration on November 1st at the Barbie Maritime Center in Astoria. The event is hosted by the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council, along with the Columbia River Maritime Museum. And you can learn all about this ancient festival that memorializes the lives of deceased loved ones. This community celebration also celebrates the continuity of life. There will be altar displays and Day of the Dead trinkets, along with a community altar, to place your own memento from a family member you want to remember that day. It's free to the public, and it runs from 1 p.m. till 6 p.m. If you'd like to see some Dios de los Muertos-inspired art, you might check out Luminari Arts on 11th and Commercial Street in downtown Astoria. Artist Diane Jackson has installed a life-sized papier-mâché altar installation that features Guillermo the Mariachi and Winifred, his beloved, in an after-death repose. Also featured are Day of the Dead dolls by Charlotte Brun and Alec Isaacson. The gallery's open from 10 a.m. to 6. The Day of the Dead celebrations are all around us, and they are likely to become even more popular. So, if you're choosing a Halloween costume, remember, sugar skulls aren't really about Halloween, so you might want to pass on dressing up as a calaveras de azúcar. But if you want to dress up like one and decorate with sugar skulls, how about having a Dios de los Muertos party on November 1st instead? The beautiful tradition of honoring our relatives who have passed on, complete with fabulous food, decorating an altar, and inviting friends to bring items from someone they want to remember and honor. And keep the zombies and monsters where they belong, way back in October. This is Carrie Gallagher for Coast Community Radio.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part or just want to hear it again, it is on our website as a podcast at coastradio.org. We appreciate your comments. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's N-E-W-S and the numeral 1, and put The Bridge in the subject line. Thanks to Carrie Gallagher this morning, and thanks to you for listening. See you next time on The Bridge. Thank you.